Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And I'm going to look tonight at the relationship between the CIA, American presidents, and covert operations, particularly as it relates to the Iran-Contra scandal under President Ronald Reagan, and the fact that these twin scandals, and the Iran scandal and the Contra scandal, these two twin covert operations, were directly under the kind of the purview of the president and connected to him and his whims intimately. One of the things that is often overlooked by historians, normally quite favourable historians to Ronald Reagan, is the extent to which he employed the CIA in Central America to facilitate crimes in Nicaragua and other countries. And as with most American presidents, historical amnesia means that they tend to be judged extremely leniently by the official record. In almost every single case, I think as Noam Chomsky pointed out, had the Nuremberg laws been applied evenly, every post-war president would have been hanged for crimes against humanity. So tonight I'm looking at Theodore Draper's History of the Iran-Contra Affair, A Very Thin Line. And he paints a very compelling contextual picture of the CIA and the office of the president. He writes, "Until the Bay of Pigs debacle in 1961, the CIA did very much as it pleased in the conduct of covert activities, its special monopoly. Unlike President Reagan 25 years later, President Kennedy accepted full responsibility for the failure, as President Eisenhower had done when a CIA reconnaissance plane had been shot down over the Soviet Union the year before. Kennedy finally ended Alan Dulles' long career as CIA director without doing much to change the way the CIA did business covertly. Kennedy's successor, Lyndon B. Johnson and Richard M. Nixon, finally brought on a revolt in Congress, which had long failed to bear its share of constitutional responsibility for foreign policy in general and war-making powers in particular. The Vietnam War and the CIA's embroilments in Chile and elsewhere, among other things, led Congress to make a major effort to change the rules which had previously governed relations with the executive branch." So all of this is vital context for understanding the Iran-Contra affair, the means by which weapons were given to Iran the mortal enemy of the United States, and funding given to the Contras, the murderous anti-Sandinista guerrillas of the deposed of the previous Somoza regime, who beheaded and butchered their way across Nicaragua and beyond, armed and equipped by the CIA in order to destabilise a broadly popular socialist regime in Nicaragua, run by the Ortega brothers, and eventually returned to the type of rule that the US preferred. When largely under duress, the Nicaraguan population voted in 1990 for Violeta Chamorro, who spent much of her time in office overturning the progressive changes that had been introduced under the Sandinista regime. So by the 1980s, neither the presidency nor the CIA had the free hands that they used to. As Draper points out, it has been kind of explored before in this podcast, in the first two decades of the CIA's existence, it was to some degree a law unto itself. The CIA established a military room was never quite meant to be the vast organisation that it became. Instead, it was designed to be a kind of a daily information service for the president. Truman himself was particularly weak on foreign affairs and had a particularly weak understanding of world events. He needed a briefing. He wound up with a large organisation under the likes of Wild Bill Donovan, who presumed it was their role to take a covert war to the Soviet Union against communism itself. In many instances, the CIA were not particularly interested whether the governments they were overthrowing were communist or whether they were simply nationalist movements, national liberation movements that had come to power in places like Indonesia or Chile, and were embracing such projects as land reform and the distribution of land to the peasants. Ideas no doubt influenced by socialist thinking, but not necessarily a strategic threat to the USA or part of the Soviet sphere of influence. Regimes such as these were overthrown regardless. So the first clipping of wings came under the War Powers resolution post-Watergate. It required the president to submit a report to Congress within 48 hours of any involvement of US armed forces in hostilities or in, and I quote, situations where imminent involvement in hostilities is clearly indicated by the circumstances. The Gulf of Tonkin incident and other casus belli that had been used by the United States in order to make a case for war now could no longer be wafted through the House in such kind of ambiguous pretexts. It also required the President to terminate such involvement within 60 days after submitting his report if Congress had not approved his action. So this in theory meant that military action needed to go through Congress. However, in the subsequent decades after the War Powers Resolution, Congress has repeatedly voted for the most ill-advised military actions, you know, of course, the Iraq War being but one. without really the War Powers Resolution getting in the way at all. It presumes that there is an activist Congress that will scrutinise the decisions of the President and that have a vested interest in preventing wars, and that appears in most instances to not be the case. The War Powers Resolution was obviously, writes Theodore Draper, far from being a foolproof congressional check on the President. It did not cover covert wars or paramilitary activities, such as the CIA later conducted in Nicaragua. It was restricted to the United States Armed Forces and left room for the use of unofficial or surrogate forces, such as the Nicaraguan Contras subsequently represented. It made Congress irrelevant if the armed action was completed in less than 60 days, as in the case of Grenada in October 1983 and Panama in December 1989. So the legislation had serious loopholes in it, loopholes that were exploited by the CIA and by the presidency, and the loopholes that shape the nature of conflicts to come. Nixon saw fit to veto the resolution. It was passed over his veto in November 1973. However, Nixon announced that he was not going to be able to abide by this resolution on the ground that he considered it to be unconstitutional, thereby aggregating to himself the power given to the Supreme Court to decide on constitutionality. His Republican successors, Ronald Reagan and George Bush, have both followed Nixon's example and they refused to recognise the War Powers Resolution as binding on them. Later, Congress did have greater successes in dealing with the problem of covert operations that were given the green light by the presidency. For example, the Hughes-Ryan Amendment to the Foreign Assistance Act meant that the president had to find that each covert activity is important to national security of the United States. Unfortunately, national security became such an elastic term that there was very little that could not eventually, in subsequent decades, be kind of stuffed under that particular umbrella. There was a time limit placed on the president's report to Congress. But this is ambiguous in itself. It was just referred to that the president must report in a timely manner. Another important measure, writes Draper, was added in 1980. Then an Intelligence Oversight Act sought to stiffen the reporting requirement by obligating the president to provide the Congressional Intelligence Committees with prior notice of any significant anticipated intelligence activity, including covert operations. In return, the number of congressional committees, in effect, the only chairman, only the chairman and vice chairman, to which the president was supposed to report, was reduced from 8 to 2. So everything is really gradually, over time, gerrymandered back in favour of the presidency and the CIA and other covert branches of the US, the US government. But there were a couple of details that would come back to haunt the Reagan administration. The first was the need for a thing called the Presidential Findings. And these were to be written documents describing the need and nature of covert operations and bearing the president's signature. The second was the obligation to report to the appropriate congressional committees in a timely fashion. This term was not defined but was understood to mean a matter of days or at the most weeks, not months or years or whenever the president should be pleased to do so. The Reagan administration itself codified the entire intelligence system on December the 4th, 1981. In an executive order, which was Executive Order 12333. The National Security Council was described as the highest executive branch entity that provides review of, guidance for, and direction to the conduction of all national foreign intelligence, counterintelligence, and special activities, and attendant policies and programs.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
When one codifies things, one inadvertently removes any ambiguity. And ambiguity is really, really important when you're trying to bamboozle and lie to committees of the US Congress. Clearly setting out who is responsible for what was to have significant consequences for Reagan later on during the Iran-Contra affair. So the first part of the scandal, the involvement between the Reagan administration and the Contras, began before Reagan even set foot in the White House. On July the 17th, 1979, at the end of the Carter administration, the 42-year-old dictatorship of the Somoza junta in Nicaragua collapsed. It was overthrown by a broad revolutionary coalition known as the Sandinista National Liberation Front, which took its name from the Nicaraguan revolutionary leader Augusto César Sandino. Beginning in 1926, he had waged a guerrilla war against the US occupation of Nicaragua until he was tracked down and killed in 1934 by the local National Guard, commanded by its US-trained and appointed General Anastasio Somoza, who was the patriarch of the Somoza dynasty. So the using of Sandino's name was a clear message to the Somoza ruling family that trouble was on the way. The Carter administration decided to treat the new regime with a little bit of goodwill, quite an uncommon goodwill, all things considered, when similar regimes had emerged in Cuba and Guatemala. They had not been treated with anywhere near that degree of courtesy. Nicaragua received $39 million of in emergency food aid from the US in 1979 and another $60 million in emergency economic assistance in 1980. There were figures within the State Department who looked upon the Somoza regime and its demise with a little bit of relief. This was becoming quite an embarrassment, the ability of America to make any sort of meaningful claim that it was the protector of democracy around the world was always undermined by these local thugs. So Carter was perhaps happy to kind of have a punt, really, on the Sandinistas to see if there was some kind of positive rapport that the two sides could have. However, at the same time, Carter signed a finding in 1979 to support the democratic elements in Nicaragua in what promised to be a bitter struggle with extremists. When the moderates and extremists in the Sandinista movement began to fall apart, the latter increasingly seized the upper hand. The two moderate members, Violeta Chamorro, before she shifted fundamentally to the neoliberal right, and Alfonso Rebelo, found it necessary to resign from the five-member governing council. Daniel Ortega, the left leader of the Sandinistas, emerged as what was described as the Nicaraguan Castro. The Sandinistas gave support to leftist guerrillas in El Salvador and began to send arms from Nicaragua. In March 1980, a Sandinista delegation went to Moscow and signed economic, technical, scientific and cultural agreements with the Soviet Union, and Cuban advisors moved into Nicaragua. From the point of view of Washington, this is all nightmarish. This is losing Central America. Whether Moscow was in any way seriously interested in Nicaragua or saw it as a kind of a small bit of leverage in America's backyard is debatable. I can't genuinely believe that Nicaragua had that much strategic value to a post-Cuban Missile Crisis USSR. When Reagan was inaugurated in 1981, US policy had completely shifted. The Republican electoral platform had virtually called for the overthrow of the Sandinista regime. Now, if you look at how the Republican Party currently look at regimes in South America that they don't like the look of, particularly Venezuela, there's a great deal of continuity there. And let us not forget that the recently sworn-in President Biden of the Democrat Party has similar views on the Maduro regime in Venezuela. Reagan said, "We will support the efforts of the Nicaraguan people to establish a free and independent government." The administration began to make good on that pledge in February 1981. A $15 million payment was suspended to Nicaragua of a $75 million aid package kind of allotment. I've talked a lot previously on this podcast about Reagan's concepts of freedom, his way of thinking about freedom, his idea that the USA was an agent of freedom, the rolling back of the state in America, the breaking of trade union power in America, and the liberation of capital in America was really part of the long American story of freedom, and that this must be exported wherever possible. The fact that the Monroe Doctrine stated clearly that it was America's right to see Central and South America as its sphere of influence, and that any other power had no business being there. In the 19th century, this was Britain and France. But obviously, in the post-Second World War era, we're talking about the Soviet Union. This also guides American foreign policy. The CIA had first proposed a programme of covert action against the Sandinista regime in March 1981, at which time President Reagan had authorised a CIA covert programme for Central America in general. Reagan signed National Security Decision Directive 17 to provide covert support for the anti-Sandinistas on November the 17th. A finding of December the 1st covered up this decision by stating that the US aim was merely to interdict the flow of arms from Nicaragua to El Salvador. So this was how the presidential findings were kind of counteracted. You just lie and you kind of distort the truth. Much has obviously been made, and with very, very good reason, of the last 4 years of massive lies and fraudulent dishonesty by ex-President Trump. But it is worth looking at the fact that much of this is part of a trend as opposed to an aberration. The difference, perhaps, is that when previous presidents have deceived, they haven't had the amplification of social media, and also they have had perhaps a slightly better ability to charm the centre ground of US politics and the US populace while deceiving them. With Trump, that's not quite the same thing. Two anti-Sandinista forces, the FRS, the Sandinista Revolutionary Front, Eden Pastora, were Sandinistas who had broken away from the Sandinista movement, believing it had moved too far to the left, emerged, the FRS was based in Costa Rica. In Honduras, another anti-Sandinista force made up of Somoza's National Guard and headed by Enrique Bermudez was founded. Bermudez succeeded in bringing together a small group of former National Guard officers and anti-Sandinista civilians to form the Fuerza Democrática Nicaraguanese, the Nicaraguan Democratic Force, or FDM. This force was repeatedly accused of seeking to restore the Somozas to power, and was opposed to Pastora. The feeling was pretty mutual, and the CIA eventually chose Bermudez to work with. The problem with Pastora is that had he seized power, he would equally have not wanted United States influence in Nicaragua. The first attempt to train the anti-Sandinista force in Honduras was made by the pliant Argentine military, also a fascistic organisation under the sway of CIA influence. And unfortunately for the Argentine CIA relationship, when eventually the US helped Britain during the Argentinian invasion of the Falklands, the relationship rather soured, and it was followed eventually by the overthrow of the Argentinian junta led by General Galtieri. In the course of 1982, the CIA took over the entire Contra operation. Contra being this sort of the umbrella term for the various secret, covert, anti-Sandinista groups who eventually form into one Contra army. After discussion with director William Casey, the Newsweek magazine of November 1982. Ran a story called America's Secret War in Nicaragua. Without saying as much, it conveyed the impression, writes Theodore Draper, that the United States was engaged in a covert military operation to overthrow the Sandinistas in Nicaragua, or, as the story put it, to undermine the Sandinista government. One of the repercussions of this article was a forceful editorial denunciation in the Boston Globe. Among its readers was Representative Edward P. Boland of Massachusetts, the chairman of the House Select Committee on Intelligence. Casey denied the story had come to the committee, but boasted that the numbers of the Contra force had grown from 500 to 4,000. One of Casey's problems was that he did not give the impression of a man who could be automatically trusted. And that would be a metaphor for the rest of the Iran-Contra scandal. We haven't focused on Iran yet, but we will do as we look more at Draper's work in subsequent podcasts. Anyway, I hope you find this useful. The new website, explaininghistory.org, is now up and running. It's where I'll be posting some various bloggings in the not-too-distant future. You can find a link to our Patreon there. If you're able to make a donation to keep the podcast solvent, that would be great. And I will catch you on the next Explaining History podcast, and hopefully we'll be speaking to Mick Wright tomorrow, which will be a great honour for the podcast indeed, as a fantastic journalist he is. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.